Welcome everyone back to Midweek Mysticism. We are live. If you are in the matte edition of the Zohar, which I will share on the screen in a moment, but we're using Daniel Matt's English edition. We are on page
133.
133.
Yes, I think.
That right?
Yes. Yes.
We'll get to it. Me share the screen. So we are commenting on what we're doing right now is we're going through the verses of creation, and there's a plain meaning to the verses, and there are, levels of interpretation, and the Zohar is now giving us the sod, the deepest mystical meaning. There's the classic Pardes paradigm, standing for pshat, plain meaning, remez, the hint, the allusion, drash, and the sod, the last letter of garden, the secret. And we are going through the secret meaning. Very often, the secret meaning is an expansion of the themes in the Midrash or the Drash. So the Zohar is very intentionally taking the plain meaning and what is in the text, the Remez and the Drash, the literally the Midrashic rabbinic tradition about the verses and what they mean. And then the mystical meaning is related to that. So it's layered in, it emanates, and it's not a foreign thing. It's not unrelated to. And that relationship, the Zohar expects us to be doing in terms of analysis. What is the relationship between the secret meaning of the verse and the plain meaning of the verse? And so that's always the question that we're going to be asking, particularly in this section. It's true for the whole Zohar, but it's particularly true for its commentary on the 7 days of creation, where it really keeps to that form. And where there's a lot of very rich midrashic material that's famous, relatively famous. Famous is relative. Okay, we are now commenting on the verse Yihi Rakia. Yes, let there be a an expanse betoch hamayim. And separate between water and water. That's the verse we're talking about. Is this where we are? We're here, right?
Yep.
I had us a line or two before. If you go to the previous page, I think that's where you'll see the.
Oh, there we are. Okay, you're right. Ale. God. So first what I'll do, since there are some new folks here, welcome. The way I'll usually do it, which is what multiple teachers of Zohar I've studied with have done, is first to read the Zohar through to get a sense of the rhythm, the sound, the poetry, and the meaning, and then to kind of repeat it a few times and then to begin to analyze. Everything will be always confusing and cryptic upon the first read. So that's the design. It's supposed to not make sense. Then we'll make it make sense. Then it'll transform our consciousness. Okay. El, God, cluster on the right. El Gadol, great God. From the midst of the waters, an expanse expanded to complete this name. El, to merge in that expansion. One in the other, and from El expanded Elohim, God. The letters, Hey, Yud, Mem, the final letters of Elohim, expanded and were transposed into lower waters, Yama, Yud, Mem, Hey. That expansion expanding on the second day is the upper waters, Hey, Yud, Mem. This vast Hayam, sea, the sea. is the upper waters. The transposition of these letters, Yud Mem He, is the lower waters. Once arrayed, all become one entity, this name extending to various realms. The upper waters are male, the lower waters female. At first, water intermingled with water until they were separated to distinguish upper from lower. These are Elohim, God, and these are Adonai, Lord. Upper, He, and lower, He. What is written? Elohim fashioned the expanse. This expansion took this name, Elohim, upper waters, while the lower waters are Adonai. Nevertheless, once male waters were completed by female waters, the name Elohim extended over all. That's the first part of a multi-part thing. So this is like a narrative. We don't actually usually get this, like a long Zohar, and it's a mythic narrative. I just want to name myth as a kind of genre here. We have this mythic setting of these waters, these gendered waters, intermingling with a creative, nearly sexual energy in the early creation on the second day. So let's...
Could we just stop for a minute with the sexual analogy here? I mean, it seems that this, our earliest Paleolithic ancestors understood that there was a sky god and a mother earth, and who was also a god. And she died every winter and was resurrected fertile and a virgin every spring. So this is fitting, it seems to me, this fits in with a much more ancient mythological structure of God impregnating the earth, and God is in the sky, and the goddess is in the earth. Does that make any sense? Or
yeah, so there's a lot to say here, just to unpack this. There's a reason it's like trendy in modern, very liberal Jewish circles to be like pro-pagan, right? Or to say like, I'm a Canaanite priestess or something like that, right? Like without, right? Like, why is it trendy? You know, it's because there's a sense in which for a long time, the Jewish mystical tradition was in touch with or trying to view favorably or sanitize human spiritual traditions, many of which were pagan or deified various elements of the natural world, devotionally, including worship to those, right? That's part of the Avodah Zarah. The key part is the devotion, not just the thought crime. You know, if you're a rationalist, you're focused on these thought crimes. But so the Zohar actually is very much trying to do the opposite of the Rambam. Right. He's trying to anti-mythologize, to take away all the myth. It's reintroducing even new creative mythology with deified personalities. But it's doing the Zohar two step, or the sanitizing cleanse, the thing which it does, which it even does here. And we're going to get to that, which is to then make all of these things one. Right. To say that actually, these are all different flavors of parts of, you know, so it yes, the Zohar views ancient spiritual traditions, I think, affirmatively, and an ancient mythological worldview as something which Melila Haldet-Eschner writes that actually one of the animating features of the Zohar, and she thinks that this is true from the Idras, the most epic portions of the Zohar, you can tell that the Zohar thinks that mythology is a crucial part of the human condition, and the accumulated cultural history of all of this has theological weight and value, and that we shouldn't dismiss as purely negative the theological, cultural history of human spirituality. So you get that in the Zohar a lot. So I guess the answer is yes. Is that a does am I saying anything? Yes. Anyone else want to comment on this? Which is
Now,
why.
this is interesting because my grandson recently asked me why he has to learn about these Greek gods. Nobody, it's a religion nobody follows in contemporary times. And I didn't have a particularly good answer, but
Well, I
now
will
I
give
can
you
go
the answer
back.
to him. You should know, this is an aside, that the birthday ritual, in Greek mythology, fire and music were seen as related, and there was a tradition on birthdays to light fire and pray over those fires while singing songs, which is the origin of like happy birthday and candles and wishes and that whole thing. It was actually a very important Greek mythological ritual with a lot of manifestation. And there are other such things which have become trivialized in our society. But, to say that no one observes Greek mythology, I always use the birthday ritual as an example of a very watered down.
That's great.
So I can give you more on that. But the song and the fire are supposed to interact in ways that make a propitious time for prayer. And new openings, so it's not like a small thing, the birthday wish, if you're a Greek, ancient Greek. Okay, so let's go through this a little bit. El God cluster on the right, El Gadol. Here, just to be understand, El was really like day one, yeah, and represents chesed, loving kindness, the very first of God's emanations, and gedulah, greatness. And sometimes chesed is called gedulah, greatness. In Kabbalah, the greatness of God is God's compassion, right? Let's just be clear about it, is God's loving kindness. That's the greatness. It's in this context you can view what's his name's new. Shai Held's new book about love in Judaism, trying to reclaim that and other such things, right? There's a strong trend in Kabbalah to prioritize ontologically, to say the first, emanated kind of move after the intellect of wisdom and bina is loving kindness. And that's on the right. And here they literally call it cluster on the right. Great God. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to say about that. Now, from the midst of the waters, an expanse expanded to complete this name. The waters are seen as like a womb here, Bina. And so it's a place, there's an expansion happening here. But when they say an expanse expanded to complete this name, they're evoking explicitly the imagery of a pregnant woman whose belly is growing. Or they're evoking it. They're not making a direct comparison, but that's what should resonate here. They have that, I've got to think in mind, because Bina is the divine mother. And so you kind of you anyway, from the midst of the water, an expanse expanded to complete this name El, to merge in that expansion, one in the other, and from El expanded Elohim. So Elohim is a name. So here we're really dealing with the emanation of the names of God in a certain way. After El, Chesed, you get Gevurah, right? What's the counterbalance to loving kindness? The counterbalance to loving kindness is some strictness or judgment. If loving kindness is to give someone, it's toughness, fighting, discord, or in its extreme version, hell, which we learned about in an earlier teaching, right? Or terrorism. But here it's just the plain version of it, Gevurah. And that is associated with Elohim. Elohim can be Bina, Elohim can be Gevurah, and Elohim can be Shekhinah. It's all the feminine things can be Elohim. Now, if you look, the names El and Elohim are related. They're just three extra letters. So the Zohar understands and is trying to state that the relationship between these formal proper names of God is one of literally expansion. Do you follow? In other words, the name expanded, like the name El grew to a bigger name, Elohim. And what are the letters of the expansion of the name? They are waters. right? So in other words, and what is the thing that is expanding water? And so there's a liquid imagery here of God's flow expanding and flowing like water, as God's, whatever you want to call it, there are different metaphors in the Kabbalah, moves closer to reality as we perceive it, to humans and creation. Now, the letters Hayam, literally the sea, Hayad Mem, expanded and were transposed into lower waters, Yud Mem Hay, literally Yama, or toward the sea. That expansion, expanding on the second day, is the upper waters, Hayam, this vast Hayam, sea, is the upper waters. The transposition of these letters, Yama, is the lower waters. So what are the lower waters? The lower waters are Shechina. I really should load the chart. I don't know which version this is, but I'm going to open it. Okay, this is not the most up-to-date version of the chart. Do people see the chart, or I have to reshare? Rabbi Confer, apologies. This is not your most updated version of the chart, but it'll do for our purposes. It's the one that came up on my computer. So just if we're doing it, right? From Bina, expands. So we get Chesed. The interaction of Chesed and Bina produces Gevura. Here you can literally see it in this line. The Zohar is describing this line of, the Zohar is describing lines of spiritual energy, if you want to view it graphically. And so when from Chesed an expanse expanded, right, and these waters produce these waters. So we get Gevura here, which is Elohim. We go from El to Elohim. These are these pathways. And then we go from Elohim to Shechina, to the kind of reality. We get water. So imagine these lines are canals of divine energy, and there's water flowing between them. That's what the Zohar is imagining. There's liquid, so to speak, flowing. And so the energy of Elohim, of strictness, produces Shechina. Now, what's important here already is that our reality is governed most proximately by Elohim, by strictness. In other words, we live in a world where, I don't know, what comes around goes around, and people are tough and difficult. We also live in a world of loving kindness, but okay. Now, once arrayed, and do you see how the waters, even though they're different, but they're the same letters, and even the ones that aren't the same letters are expansion of the thing before. That's a way of symbolizing or showing that the divine energy, which is starting and transforming, look, Ani Hashem Lo Sheniti, says the prophet, I'm God, I do not change. This God is changing a whole lot. So this change isn't really a change. This is the two steps, or the sanitization, says the Zohar, right? It's just an expansion, a growing outward, an overflow in Neoplatonic language. Or a morphing, a switching of the order of things. It appears different, but really behind it all, it's the same essence that kind of is like emerging or becoming or whatever you would want to say. Okay.
Does anywhere in the Zohar acknowledge any sort of debt to Paulinus or to other Neoplatonists? Or is it just assumed that everybody knows?
There are a couple of occasions where direct language is borrowed. Word for word in translation. So people assume that when they borrowed, even though they plagiarize, but you can't fire the Zohar's people are anonymous. So there's no editorial committee that can call for their resignation because of their inadvertent plagiarism and whatnot. There are times where the Zohar directly plagiarizes Plotinus. And so you've got to imagine with direct plagiarization that if that's not an acknowledgement, it's at least it's got to be, they're not afraid to plagiarize. If you're not afraid to plagiarize word for word, you've got to assume that those who know will recognize.
Which is frequently the Zohar's assumption. Those who know what I mean by this language. Those who don't. figure it out.
In a certain way, you can say that what Rambam did for Aristotle, which was to make Judaism conceivable in mainly an Aristotelian worldview, the Zohar...
Yeah, but he mentioned... He cites Aristotle when he quotes
him. Right, they don't cite Plotinus in the Zohar, but they don't cite much of anything here. Now, once arrayed, all became... They don't even cite the Rambam once in the Zohar, and yet half of the Zohar is a reaction to the Rambam. Yet not once is he mentioned. Because it's ancient. It imagines it's before all of it. That's the way they do it. Once arrayed, all became one entity. This name extending to various realms. So there is like a difference, but it becomes one. Yes? So you get the name of Elohim referring to Bina and referring to Gvura and referring to Shekhinah. And so that's what they mean by this name extending to various realms. The name Elohim governs in different ways, but in the same, it's the same governor in multiple spheroid. Now, the upper waters are male. The lower waters, female. So we have here, and this is an example of what I mean. If you look at note 204, the Zohar is going to quote the Midrash. Right? So this is what I mean. It's going to expand on the Midrash to take the Sod. Rabbi Shimon, son of Elazar, said, this is from Breshit Rabbah, right? The most classic Midrash. Every single handbreadth of water descending from above is met by two handbreadths emitted by the earth. What is the reason? Tahom El Tahom, quoting Psalms, deep calls to deep. That's what the psalmist says. That's meant as a praise of the hidden pathways of God. So the Zohar is going to pick up on that. Rabbi Levi said the upper waters are male, the lower female, the former cry to the latter, receive us. You are creatures of the Blessed Holy One, and we are his messengers. They immediately receive them, as written, let the earth open, like a female opening to a male. So the Midrash explicitly mentions the flow of divine water from God to the earth as a in sexual language in the Midrash of you know, a relationship, a creative relationship between God and people that leads to yet further chidush, further renewal or creation. So that's the Midrashic tradition already about these waters that are being separated, and separation allowing for a space for something other than God, namely humans, to be able to interact, right? The space is what creates the possibility of relationship, which is true in all relationships. At first, water intermingled with water until they were separated. Now, here's the problem, right? When you have two liquid mediums, they mix and they become a right? So you needed energy of Havdalah. Now, what is the thing that creates the energy of separation? Spiritually, that is Gvura. Gvura is the sphera, is the divine energy which creates separate, is able to distinguish one thing from another. That's Gvura kind of energy. You over here and you over here. You imagine a parent keeping two children apart, right? So at first, water intermingled with water until they were separated. I'm adding by the power of Gvura to distinguish upper from lower. These are Elohim, God, and these are Adonai, Lord, upper He and lower He. We're going to come back to this theme, but the divine name, Yud He Vav He, the classic most important divine name, happens to have the same letter as its second letter and its fourth letter. In Kabbalah, this is reflective of the two waters, or the idea that that which is above is truly the same as that which is below. It's just a flowing down in a particular point in the pathway. And so the name Elohim is the name of Bina or and Gvura and Shekhinah above. But Shekhinah is most directly represented by the name we use when we make brachot and relate to God, which is Aleph Dalet Nun Yun. It's the one we say instead of the shame of Vayera. We don't say Yud Hey Vav Hey, we say this. And this represents the final hey, or the last sphera of Shekhinah. When we make a bracha, Baruch Atah Adonai, Adonai there means Shechina for the Kabbalists. That's what it means, right? It's the God we can relate to because we live in that world. We don't live in upper realms. What is written? Elohim fashioned the expanse. This expansion took this name, Elohim upper waters, while the lower waters, turn the page of the actual Zohar, are Adonai. Nevertheless, once male waters were completed by female waters, the name Elohim extended over all. Originally, when they were separate, it was Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. But once all of the waters are flowing, so the waters below receive the waters above if the channels are open. And the name Elohim, Hayam, water, Yama, going towards the sea, can be said to extend towards all. There's a flow. Do you see? So it's not that there are multiple names in a confusion, but rather these names represent different parts of Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud represents an aspirational state where divine energy isn't fully flowing into our current reality. When we make a bracha, we're almost crying out, would it be that divine energy flowed in to this world? As an aside, it is worth noting that implicit behind all of this is the Zohar sense that the word bracha, they're not talking about blessings here, but they are, is related to bricha, pool, and a thing that channels or holds the liquid medium. And so they imagine that really it's a call for upper waters to flow into our lower world, or the act of blessing or engaging devotionally with God is what causes divine energy to flow into our world. Through our own perception, through our own creation. In this way, it is kind of like postmodern, like our own spiritual sensibility of what we do creates the spiritual reality. So the Zohar is aware that it's constructing a system, and the construct of that system is what makes it so. Okay. Even though he separated the upper waters from the lower, the conflict did not cease until the third day arrived. What conflict? Oh, we didn't do this yet. Let me read it. Okay. Pause. So far, we're in a holding place. If you're like, what are we talking about exactly? That's okay. We're talking about the separation of upper waters and lower waters as male, masculine and feminine energy being both separate but poised for relationship. This can be seen as a microcosm of the idea, midrashically, that Adam and Eve were created back to back as a single being and had to be separated before they could then interact with each other. Even though he separated the upper waters from the lower, the conflict did not cease until the third day arrived, harmonizing the conflict, and everything settled fittingly into place. Because of this conflict, although it sustains the world, that it was good is not written of the second day, for the act was incomplete. Upper waters and lower waters mingled, and nothing generated in the world until they were separated and distinguished, thereby generating offspring. Even so, although the separation took place on the second day, and the conflict arose then, the third day harmonized everything. For it is the name engraved with the engravings, hey, bav, hey, harmonizing upper and lower waters, upper hey, lower hey, vav between them, pacifying the two sides. This is the sign. The waters of the Jordan, upper waters, rose in one heap. The lower waters flowed down into the sea, and Israel passed between. Okay. So before we learned that, why was the second day not good? In other words, of every day of the 7 days of creation is written, it was good or very good. But the second day, that is not written.
Because the conflict had not yet been made fertile. Yet, so, and therefore gave rise, which you said last time, to some sort of concept of hell. You just have Gevurah not mediating chesed, just creating right. On its own.
So they imagine on the second day conflict was created, but that conflict was not a constructive conflict. It was lo l'shem shamayim, not for the sake of heaven, or literally destructive. And it got so conflict for its own sake can spiral out of control, as it did, says the Zohar, leading to the creation of hell and demons, which ultimately had to be cut out or amputated from the divine body. And so that's how hell even exists, is because it was originally within the kind of divine world, but eventually God had to say, like, enough. It just got, it spiraled out of control, even too much for God, even. And so it maintained energy from its original influence from God, but was cut off from an active kind of relationship in the balanced system of the sphere rope, as Peter Berman just described. Here we get a slightly different frame of that, which is that there's a conflict between loving kindness and gevura, strength, right? That is, I mean, this is the great conflict of all things, political, interpersonal, right? So how to be kind to people and the role of distinguishing, being critical, being judgmental, being different, being strict, fighting with versus loving, joining with, collaborating, appreciating. How to, it's, you know, political, I think, differences stem from this, and many things stem from this. So this conflict it's interesting. It sustains the world. Why does it sustain the world? Like, if there was no conflict, if there was just uniformity, there'd be no thing other than God, right? In other words, like, we exist to struggle, to be off balance, to be squabbling. Otherwise, we wouldn't exist. It's like, it's kind of funny because the thing we wish for is to put ourselves out of business in a certain way. We imagine, we yearn for a world that would be of one mind and one heart and without conflict and strife. But then we would all just be God. You know, there wouldn't be a world, says the Zohar. The world is a world of separation and balance, right? And balance, the other side of balance is off balance. Daniela.
It's weird that they're using the translation conflict. I don't know what, I'm assuming that's a good translation, but when you're talking about this, it doesn't strike me as conflict. It strikes me as the concept of equilibrium. Equilibrium is not stasis, right? It's the constant readjusting to find the balance in the middle of two things, which doesn't necessitate it doesn't necessitate getting rid of the difference for there to be peace. It just necessitates constant motion to find the right space. So I don't know, that's what you made me think of, was that this isn't necessarily like bad. It wasn't like inherently awful, as I'm hearing it described for the first time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So they used the term machloket here.
And what was the word for harmonizing? I was curious too. Harmonizing the conflict.
Askeim machloket. The disagreement reached an agreement. Askeim machloket. Which actually sounds different than harmonizing. Askeim haskama is an agreement, like a settlement. You know, it's like they were able to reach a truce, a settlement.
Don't we use machloket in a positive sense when we're talking about debating halakha?
Yeah, so here they're using it in a positive sense too, right?
Yeah.
Right, which is, you know, but it wasn't good until the third day, because when it was just conflict, which is when you're experiencing conflict, even if, like, I'm in a fight right now with someone, it's a civil fight. It's a disagreement. I'm in a strong disagreement with someone right now who I like, and I think he likes me. But we're in a strong disagreement about something that matters. And it's stressful. I imagine at some point, like in a week, we'll have resolved this conflict one way or another, because neither of us are conflict averse and we're going at it. So at some point, something's going to give, right? And we're going to resolve our conflict because both of us are invested in resolving the conflict. But until we resolve the conflict, it's very stressful. It's not good. I wouldn't use good as the word I would use to describe how it is. Like, I don't want to go for a beer with him right now. But as soon as this conflict is settled, I would love to, right? So there's something about conflict when it is occurring and not yet settled, even though the settlement is usually inevitable, that unless it's not, is not good until there's wholeness, right? Until it's that things, because conflict is a sign that things need to be rebalanced. Now, you need conflict. As they point out, nothing generated in the world until they were separated and distinguished, thereby generating offspring, right? So, you know, here, like, until you get male and female, right and left, chesed and gevura, you don't get anything productive. You need dissonance in order to create. Even so, although the separation took place on the second day and the conflict arose, then the third day harmonized everything. So let's we're going to get to the third day in a minute, but for it is the name engraved in the engravings. Hey, Vav. Hey, and do you see there are three letters there for the third day? This is the teaching, right? So Yod is its own thing, but Yod, Hey, Vav, Hey. So Hey is the upper waters. Hey is the lower waters. And Vav is the mediator, literally the conflict mediator in between. In this version of it. You know, you kind of get it. Pacifying the two sides. This is the sign. So what do they mean by like Zahaot? This is the sign. What do you mean this is the sign? So when the Israelites entered the land of Israel, in a microcosm of the splitting of the Sea of Reeds, the Amsuf, the Jordan River splits in a miraculous moment for Joshua and the camp. And the waters rise in these heaps. And so they imagine that the two waters splitting as the Israelites cross in are a microcosm of the divine energy entering the world into the Shekhinah. Israel is coming into the land. Here represents God's energy penetrating the earth, the physical earth, and causing productivity to emerge in the land. It's a very interesting and deep realization of the Kabbalah. I'll say as an aside, these are certainly the sorts of streams of mystical thinking that often have influence in Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, for example, right, quotes this passage of the Zohar in one of his teachings. So this is, you know, if you're a religious Zionist, this can be an influential teaching about Israel entering the land and what kind of cosmic significance that represents. And if you're a Satmar Chassid, you would read this entirely differently as, you know, not really being about the land at all, but the land being a metaphor for what divine energy is, and perhaps the thing happening in the land actually being a perversion or corruption of the divine energy, because after all the people entering the land aren't even observant, etc. So, you know, you could read it anyway, but okay. And Israel.
Just in that, I'm kind of just jumped back to it because it's interesting that the Kohanim stand between the river on that in that moment in Joshua. So they're kind of the Vav in this case, holding the basically the Aron of the Brit.
Yeah, I mean, I think the people are the Vav. You know, the whole people are the Vav, kind of entering the land. So, but yes, the Kohanim being the core representatives of the people. Now, we do another Zohar kind of learning. I'm only pushing us so that we learn more because it's also good. Another way to learn in both classic biblical study and in the Zohar is to count the number of appearances of words in a section. I will say that this is one of the biblical ways of emphasizing themes that is, you know, not common in like modern English literature, but is extremely important in biblical literature. How many times does a root appear? How many, in a paragraph, etc. So the word rakia appears five times in the second day. So they imagine that five is a significant number. And it is, by the way, the academics pointed out as as also being important. So here they're going to describe what that means in mystical terms. So another way, we're not analyzing the Midrash, but we're counting the appearance of key words in significant numbers within a paragraph. Five expanses.
I have a question.
Yeah, Avi.
Is there something, sorry, I'm very new to this, so this might not be.
No, we're all new to this.
Is there something more literal about the last lion, maybe about geographically pretty literal, about the upper waters and the lower waters being the, you know, the Jordan and the sea, and then Israel being the above, the land itself of Israel being the above that?
Oh, you're saying like literally the shape of the land, or?
Yeah, it's talking about the upper waters, right? And then the lower waters, and then the thing in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
That passes in between, right? Like the Hazel Tide.
Yeah. So I think that's right. I think they're trying to say the reason this world is as it is because of the divine energy. And you'll even see manifestations of the divine energy left as physical imprints in the geography and topography and the history of the way things are. It's like attributing significance to mystical significance to every thing. Yeah.
And then I had a question a few pages back, and I don't know if any of this relates, but when you were saying Adonai and Elohim, you have the Aleph letter Yud, right?
Mm-hmm.
Adonai, the middle being Din, which was Gevura, right?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
That was the lower waters?
Yeah, so Adonai represent, let me go to the whiteboard.
Yeah, and then what would be the equivalent kind of insight into Elohim for upper waters using the other letters?
Right. So the equivalent is, there's not always a parallel, I'll say that.
Okay.
And that's what leaves this sometimes feeling a little random. But the expansion for Elohim in the Zohar is Mi and Ela. Which we got in the beginning of the Zohar in year one. So that's why you weren't here yet. So they imagine that Elohim is from the words Mi Bara Ela, who created these?
Which I'm looking at I have that chart here. It's below, or it's written at least here, below Gevura.
So Elohim can refer to Gevura, or it can refer to Bina, or it can refer to Shekhinah. But the highest manifestation of Elohim energy is Bina, is Divine Mother. Sorry. And they imagine that Elohim is the upper limit of that which we can comprehend. So when you reach the limit of what humans can possibly understand about God, that's Elohim, which is represented by the words me, right? In other words, the Yod and Mem at the end form the, if you rejigger the letters, you can get me Ela, who are these, or me Bara Ela, who created these. When you want to know, and who made that, when you're left with curiosity and wonder and befuddlement, learning Zohar, that's when you reach Bina, right? That's the last place that can be comprehended in the form of questions we can ask but not answer. It's wonder. I don't know if that answers your question, but Adonai is the most tangible representation of God, and Elohim flows down to there, but at its ultimate represents something that's the least tangible, describable possibility of God.
I'm sorry, can I point that just a little bit more, because it's a good question. It's one I had before, because we already did in the first page, like, this is what Elohim is, me, Ella. But this feels different. This is an expansion of El. So El with Hayam. Are we meant to see this as consistent, or is this just a new now for something completely different? This is another way that we can look at Elohim.
both. It's both consistent and it's and, but the reason it's different here is because that Elohim was really talking about Bina, and this Elohim is really talking about when you take El and Hayam, which is Bina, and combine them together, you get Gvura. When you take Bina and Chesed and you manifest that further, what does it really mean? Let me explain what it really means. I want to be kind to you. But in the course of my relationship of needing to be kind to you with insight, with Bina, there will come a moment between any people where my kindness to you will become challenged. Is it kind to only be kind? Or do, in order for I to be kind, I need to tell you that, I don't know, you smell. And the reason people don't like you is the stench, and you need to take a shower. At the risk of offending you and being critical about your lack of hygiene. That's a very like trivial example. There are obviously more serious examples. So at some point, kindness, when it develops or emanates, automatically becomes mixed with gvura. I am not you. I perceive things about you critically and negatively, and I will even be tough with you about it. And if you resist, I may have to institute consequences. Like, I can't be around you anymore because I can't deal. So there's a way of saying when Bina combines with Chesed equals Gvura, it's not just an equation, it has substance to it, right? Which is every attempt at being at actualizing loving kindness will involve at some point the mediation between people experience this in partnered relationships and in friendships, right? Well, and the parts of themselves and parts theory, right? Which is being kind versus chesed versus exercising gvura, which grows out of chesed, right, in an ideal world. Now, when it takes on a life of its own, it becomes demonic. When you're just critical for its own sake, you're just a pain in the ass, then it's not, or a terrorist and worse versions of it, then it's no longer in representation. But in an ideal world, it grows out of kindness, and that's the frame for it. And that's the balance that's a struggle or equilibrium in Daniela's terminology that's a struggle. So that's what we mean by El Hayam Elohim. That's a way of describing that reality using the derivation El, loving kindness, Hayam, Bina, Elohim, Gevura. That's a way of deriving that. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. And I also, just to remind, maybe for people that weren't here, we did the whole Korach, Aaron, Moshe, Korach, Hillel, rather, in Shammai thing like 2 pages ago. So that's maybe would be helpful too, to kind of recall that we were talking about like what a good conflict is and what a not good conflict is. And so, but yeah, that helps clarify my question.
Okay, so I think we will conclude here for today. Next time we will continue with, well, let me read it once through and then we'll conclude. And next time we'll open it a bit. We'll get to Raisin Cakes and Colonel Ember. We get a character, a new character, a general in the Roman army. Let me just read this. And then 5 expanses are written here. Vitality of the worlds moves through them. Conducts by them, all comprising one another. Were it not for this conflict, harmonized by the middle, they would not merge or be at peace with one another. There are 500 years to which the tree of life clings, generating verdure and offspring for the world. All the waters of creation drawn and flowing from the beginning, branch beneath it, through it. King David captures it and then distributes, as is written, he distributed among all the people, the entire multitude of Israel, a cake made in a pan and a raisin cake. Similarly, you give to them, they gather, and she rises while it is still night and gives food to her household. So this is what we'll open with next time. We will open with the metaphor of these waters being the xylem and phloem in a tree, the tree of life. And this tree of life, in order for the world to create, needs to grow and mature. So the creation of the world mirrors the process of It's not just that the tree of life is in the garden. The tree of life is the source of the world, and the maturation of the tree is what causes the world to exist. We exist in the tree of life. And so we'll discuss this religious biomimicry, I guess, or imitation of nature using this model for the tree of life, which the Arizal used this is the section that the Arizal based, you know, his, you know, he liked this metaphor. This was the one he primarily used through Chaim Vital, at least the student of one of his four classes. So we'll get to that next time as a kind of new lens. And after that, we're going to get to the gathering of the waters. So to conclude, today we discussed the divine names and the flow or emanation from on day two, from that which is above, Chesed and Gevura, and how we get from there and this conflict into the world. Really, now we're talking about the actualization of divine energy, such that we move from these kind of primary forces into something that is, they keep calling it here, verdure, something that generates offspring, something that is alive. How do you create life, actual life? That's what we're discussing. We're describing it with different mythologies and metaphors. So next time, we'll come back here. Thank you all for today's Friday. To those of you who are new or relatively new, it is great to have you. If you are confused, we're all confused. I remind you that is the point. But the more, what I will say is this, the more you get used to the symbols of the Zohar, it becomes less, you know, there's only 10 Sfirot and there's only like five names to refer to each of them. So once you get used to the 50 or so terms or metaphors or things that they use or personages or people, it becomes a system that becomes predictable and easy pretty quickly, you know, within a year or two. So thank you all, and happy Wednesday. Wednesday.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Talk, everybody. Thank you. Cool.